Okay.
There's no door to close. If there's no door to close. On that one.
That one. Just in case Patty has an attack.
I think
so,
yes.
I think so, yes.
Record.
Yep.
Ask a question, I guess.
And we're on.
Okay. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Holly.
So tell me about how you guys met. Early.
It was my doing.
Okay.
Yeah. I put an ad in the paper. I had drums,
uh-huh.
And I'd been playing them for a couple of months, and I wanted to get a band together. So I did two things. I put an ad in the paper, which cost, you know, next to nothing, and I phoned up the radio station, and because I'd heard that, you know, every now and again, there was a hot DJ in Calgary. He'd just come to town. His name was Don Lamb, and he could talk really fast, and he was the first fast-talking guy that they had in Calgary. So I phoned up, and he would give little ads, but it went something like this. He was just at the end of his show. He was going off. He says, and if you're a guitar player and you want to be a band, call Kim. Then he gave my number, and that was it, you know, and nobody called, strangely enough. And so, but I did put the ad in the paper, and I got a whole bunch of answers. And one came from Brendan, who was the bass player in the early Stampeders, and a few other guys. And so that's how it all started. So I met Rich through Brendan, and Ronnie, you know, I can't remember how he got to be with us. But
I was there. Mel Shaw managed the same band that broke up that the Rebounds, who we were called the Paintbrushes. The Rebounds, the Paintbrushes took a break from our house gig at Alexandria Hall in Calgary, where we played almost every Friday and Saturday. We were so popular because we were on the Guys and Dolls TV show. So we would take nights away from there. The Rebounds called themselves the Turpentines because we were called the Paintbrushes. So the Turpentines were going to wipe out the Paintbrushes.
But going back before that.
Yes?
I had met Brendan Little,
right,
at the CYO meeting, Catholic Youth Organization meeting at our church. Yeah, I saw him in the back of the kitchen area there with a bass guitar, playing records on his little Sears Symphony 45 player, and I introduced myself to him and I said, "Gee, it's got some pretty neat records there." And he said, "Well, I got a whole house full of records. Do you want to come over and hear them?" Because I said, "Yeah, I'm a guitar player. Why don't we get together and maybe have a listen and maybe a jam?" And that's when I met Brendan at a church. And I went over to his house, and it was wall-to-wall records. And his mother made incredible cinnamon buns. And I knew right away when I smelt those cinnamon buns upstairs, we have to have more get-togethers and more rehearsals. So it was Brendan, actually, that answered the ad in the paper that Kim had put in. Looking for band members.
Oh, so you met through Brendan then?
Yeah, and I ended up actually joining those two.
Yeah,
and I brought this weird guy from Creston called Lynn Romer with me, who had answered the ad. Yeah. And that was the first, kind of the first version of the Rebounds. And then we got, we played around a bit. Mel managed us because these guys that the band Ronnie was in, they all broke up and went their separate ways.
There was also a sprinkling. One sec, Kim.
What?
There was a sprinkling of Rich and I meeting on the occasional time at the Hudson Bay Music Department. And he'd be there kind of plinking on guitar, and I'd walk in, and he wanted to check out guitars. And say, "Hey, aren't you in school?" And "No, quit school. What are you doing here?" "Supposed to be looking for a job." "Yeah, that's what I told my mom." "Let's rock." And we'd jam there in the Hudson Bay department store, musical department, or at one of the ones in Calgary. So we had early meetings like that before all of that. So
right.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we eventually kind of got it together. Mel took over managing, and we wanted to get this band to go to England with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it required guys that would actually consider doing that. And so
I
was game.
How did you meet Mel?
we were hanging around the television show or something, and my older brother, who... he thought he could fix things, and he was a singer, and he was actually in the band. Yeah, he was singing with the Rebounds then, sort of thing, occasionally.
Race,
yeah. And so he met Mel, and out in the parking lot, Mel's car wouldn't work, and so Race kind of got it going, he said to Mel, "Well, I can fix this or that." So he went over to fix Mel's car, and in the meantime, he told him about us, and it was a wiring thing. And so when Race was finished fixing Mel's car, when he when he turned the key, the windshield wipers went on, and when he turned on the radio, the car started, and things like that. But that's kind of how that started.
Right. So what about, there was some story about Kim, you having to learn the ventures or something? Or
ventures. Well, I mean, they were, everybody was
Wipeout or something?
Yeah, all that stuff. But the Wipeout was my first thing. I was playing that on my desk at school, right?
Uh-huh.
And then everybody said, you know, well, you're a drummer, you can play Wipeout. And, you know, and that was kind of my first lick that I played. And then I learned some time and stuff like that. But when I went to this rehearsal, I came over and to meet Richard and Brendan. And they had this drummer, and his name was Alfonso. And so, you know, and he'd been playing with his dad in a wedding band and stuff like that. So anyway, I sat down at the drums, and the first thing we played was Wipeout, and Alfonso handed me the sticks and said, I'm going home.
You're the drummer. Yeah.
All of us bands in Calgary in those days started out essentially as instrumental.
Right.
We're all influenced by the instrumental bands that were having hits of the day, and that one of them was the Ventures. There was the Fireballs, Cliff Richards and the Shadows. Even mm-hmm. though Cliff Richards was a singer, the Shadows had lots of instrumentals out that we'd copy. And before we even realized we were able to sing and someone else, and I guess we were kind of influenced, at least by Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Little Richard and all those, but we never really...
Well, there was the... expensive Elvis. A microphone, you know. You can't just become a vocal band just like that.
That's right. When we did have Mike, we'd all plug the guitars, microphones, bass, everything into one amplifier.
Explosions.
So it was just instrumentals, and then eventually started to sing, and then the Beatles craze and all that.
And this is 1964.
Wow. So Mel Shaw wrote most of your songs in the early days, right?
Well, yeah, which wasn't very many.
Right.
I mean, but he did, and that was, we weren't writing. Nobody thought about it, you know.
Yeah. When did that click?
Well, you know, it was really the Beatles. I mean, Lennon-McCartney, when it started to become known that these guys actually wrote their own songs, well, you know, so that's where you get songs. You write them. Oh, geez, that's great. You know, and then I remember reading an article listed the incomes of the Beatles, the various Beatles, and I saw that Lennon and McCartney were making a lot more money than Ringo.
That is true. So, Dad, was your first song Morning Magic? What was your first song contributed to the Stampeders that you wrote?
I'm not too sure. Was it Don't Look at Her or something, or was it...
No, that wasn't your song. That was Mel's song.
Don't Look at Her?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
She's walking by your way.
Oh, was it Be a Woman?
No, that might have been. No, Be a Woman. Be a Woman. That would, because we went down to New York to... But no, that Morning Magic was first.
Morning
that
Magic.
Before that, yeah.
I forgot which one she wrote.
Yeah.
I was just dabbling with some songwriting, and I had that entity, and I guess we had booked some studio time.
Wait a minute.
At RCA in
Morning
Montreal.
Magic.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to play it. Yeah.
Could be yeah. Stirring gravy.
Who knows?
That's right. No, that was just an entity that I had come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And we had booked a recording session in Montreal, so we were going to put all these songs down. I guess we had... our first little record deal with Melbourne or something? Melbourne Records in Toronto?
No.
What was that?
No, everything we put out was on Mel's labels.
SoCan.
Was there Melbourne?
SoCan was the Mel label. And no,
that's the very beginning. Yeah. I thought Melbourne was this guy, this investor in Toronto.
Oh, yeah? Well, I don't remember that. You sure you're not hallucinating? There?
No.
It was Crosswalk, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The guy was a big fat guy.
And that label, the label made up, it looked like it had spots and dots. It was a polka
That's
dot
right.
label, yeah.
And the reason we didn't make it was the guy that ran the record company wasn't Jewish.
So, Crosswalk was kind of your... That was after the six Stampeders broke.
Yeah.
Broke off.
Yeah.
And Crosswalk was when you guys became three.
That was the first single of the three of us, yeah.
Right. So, why did you guys split up?
Well, Race went nuts, Brendan just got tired and wanted to go. They were all older, like between six and 7 years older than us, so we're still in our late teens, 19 mm-hmm. and 20, and these guys are in their mid to late 20s. They didn't you know, they were tired of living on absolutely no money, sleeping in the worst hotels in the world.
And as well, they were influenced by different styles. They did very well on Roy Orbison. What else?
Oh, the Righteous Brothers.
Right. So I guess at this time,
Tom Jones, that sort of thing, and somehow, without even saying the words, we could kind of sense that us three younger guys wanted to go be arena rockers,
right,
and that kind of stuff and material would only get us to Las Vegas,
right?
In a cabaret setting.
Yeah.
So that's probably what also clashed, besides them getting tired of the grind.
Yeah, and. They were older. They had reached that stage of their life where they couldn't see this going anywhere, and they wanted to have a life. Mm-hmm. And so they left, and, one at a time sort of thing. They mm-hmm. gradually broke down. Van was the last guy to go.
And they all amounted to nothing.
Okay. So who are the most interesting people that you've met? The most memorable...
You mean famous people or just great
people? Two of the girls I ever loved before.
You never met him.
I met a dead person once.
I don't know. We didn't really befriend any real famous people. I mean, Wolfman was fun. He was so much like Ronnie, though. It was just basically like knowing the same guy.
Yeah, that's right. And he talked like me, too.
I heard you guys met Colonel Sanders.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, only in... because he used to live in Mississauga. He'd run into the airport and on a couple of TV shows and stuff.
Yeah. Are we into Brushes with Fame and people we've met?
Yeah, that's Brushes with Fame.
Okay, well, I was 11, 12 years old, and the Three Stooges were playing at the Calgary Stampede, and there we were in the Hudson Bay Store. Boy, we went out there a lot. And there was Larry walking around. Larry, how could that be? He was only on TV.
The Three Stooges.
Yes, and then we saw Mo downstairs, and we said, Mo, wow, Mo. And he said, yeah, hi, kids. He said, we saw Larry upstairs. You want us to take you to him? No, I'll just sniff him out. And he was going along like that. Then he gave us all a trading card, all pre-signed, and we looked down on it. And as we looked up, where'd he go? Brush with Fame.
Yeah, well, he's as interesting as anyone I've ever met.
Three Stooges, oh, yeah.
Orbison, we tried to give him our food bill.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
My brother Van was always a jokester. And us early six-man stampeders, where he was within, we went to see Roy Orbison at the Corral in Calgary, and we kind of followed them like stalking across the hotel, across the McLeod Trail there. And... the only ones in the restaurant was Roy Orbison, his band, and us, sitting about five tables over. So Van goes over, and he says, pardon me, Mr. Orbison, can I please have your autograph? Oh, certainly. And I said, no, down here at the bottom of the check.
Did he actually sign it?
You rascal. No, you rascal. The whole band laughed, and we saw that they laughed, and we all piled over like an avalanche. Yeah, man, we're in.
That's funny. Can we talk about... I don't know where I'm at sometimes in that recording session.
Well, it's one of the writings that kept me from going nuts. I thought, write about this insanity, and I tried to include as many of the happenings that did happen to us of the day, and we had a lot of in-jokes in there. There was a booking agent... who shall go unnamed, Ron Scribner, and we called him Oinky because he was, I don't know, he used to kind of chew from his little hairs from his beard or something like that. And we said, Oinky. So Oinky's got a booking 1,000 miles away. What's the rest of that line, Kim?
Looking in the mirror now, my hair is turning gray. I get tired.
So
it ended up with basically us imitating and just making noises, and we had all these jokes and silly things and people we imitated, and we just kind of started to pile it on, and it became just a cacophony of noise.
Yeah.
And you're going to play that one, I suppose,
just
to get even with us for everything that we've ever done to you.
Definitely.
It kind of was my interpretation of what the music business meant to me at that time in my life. Don't know where I'm at sometimes.
It was quite early in your career.
It was.
Not like it's changed much.
Exactly. Dad, where did you get the idea for a double neck guitar?
where did I get the idea? Well, I always liked electric 12-string.
And when we went three men, it just made sense to have that extra arsenal, you know, that extra guitar to go to and not have to be switching guitars all the time. It was convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the sound of it. You know, and I thought it was sort of cool to have a double neck, and nobody had one at the time. And so a good friend of mine, Pete Trainer, who made amplifiers at the time in the 70s here in Toronto, allowed me to use one of his carpenters at his factory, and we put it together, put two guitars together, and cut them all up and glued them and everything, and then I had a double neck guitar. And I didn't have to wait 10 years from Fender for a custom made one, so yeah. So
homemade,
I still have it.
Kind,
still
homemade.
Have it. One of a kind, yep.
And what about the banjo on Sweet City Woman?
Just a quick last-minute idea on the way to the studio. Just rented one at a music store and popped it on. And
I remember the story.
No, that's not the story.
No, the story is, you know, you got that line in there, Rich. Says, my banjo and me, we got a feel for singing. Why don't you do the riff on banjo? And he said, I don't know how to play banjo. It's a different tuning. One of us, I won't say me, why don't you tune the banjo like a guitar? Yeah, that's an idea. So the funny part was, real banjo players for years afterwards would come up to us with these mutant positions on their necks. And is this how you do that? Then we'd tell them that we tuned it like a guitar.
You
they
cheated.
Said, that's a sacrilege. You don't do that. That's how the story goes.
So we just don't want to admit guilt for all of those banjo player suicides.
And what about your stage outfits? Tell me about those thigh-high boots you wore, Dan.
We wanted to be bigger than life.
I think we just got in touch with a designer who came up with some ideas. And was that Marilyn Brooks, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, but
we were also influenced by Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Yeah, exactly. There was lots of influences, you know, hashed ideas around.
Right.
Well, and you got to remember, it was the 60s. Well, it was the 70s, but I mean, in the 60s, I mean, there was a place called Master John's in Toronto, and the guy made, he was a boot maker, and just for a joke, he put in his window these boots that were 3 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
I guess they caught his eye, I don't know.
And I'd go to him, I'd see some jacket hanging with fringes down to your knees and what have you, and I'd say, can you make pants to match that? And he'd say, yeah, sure. You give me $400 per suit. So I started wearing all sorts of leathers on stage.
Right.
Well, try that under the hot lights and see how long it takes to dry them. 4 nights, and then try to get them cleaned. Oh,
yeah,
God,
yeah.
We look good, but hey,
yeah.
It's a big full-time job.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And where did your native Canadian influence come from? Because I know a lot of your costumes.
And costumes. I mean, for some reason, we...
there's Calgary Stampede.
There's the heritage of that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And we were confronted with it always from when we were kids. Go to the Stampede. Oh, Indian Village over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the cowboy and Indian movies that we were all subject to early in our lives.
And they were the best basketball players at our school. Profit. Yeah.
And then...
Well, and we learned something about their real power just before we left Calgary, because there used to be an Indian village at the Stampede, and they wanted a raise. They wanted to get a little money for coming down there and entertaining the tourists, and the Stampede board wouldn't pay them that year. So they didn't come down, and it rained every single day for the whole Stampede.
And things like that. And I was influenced by the movie Little Big Man as well as...
that's a true movie.
There was a commercial on TV with old Iron Horse, I believe was his name, a native standing up alongside of a freeway, and a speeding car would throw garbage at his feet, and the camera would pan up and catch a tear coming down his eye. That inspired me to write Then Came the White Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great song. Next page. So, Kim, tell me about all of your drums, the see-through drums, and that goldfish thing, and the fire.
Oh, yeah, all right. I mean, I had seen, I had regular drums. I had a set of Rogers drums, which were blue and black, and you know, they were nice and everything, but I wanted a bigger kit, because we'd had a couple of records out, and there was a little bit of money, and so I had seen these fiberglass drums, which you can see through. They're clear, right? And so I thought, well, that's showbiz. I'm going to get some of those. And so I did. I had the first set. I ordered them from there. They were German, actually. And I had the first set in Toronto or in Canada, probably. And I had a great big set. I had a whole bunch of tom-toms. And they were really good for a lot of things. And you're like the fire thing. I would light some sticks on fire, like timpani sticks sort of thing, and soak them in fluid and then light them on fire and play a drum solo on all the tom-toms, and which was great, except the heads would go on fire and they would melt, and then you wouldn't have anything to play for the rest of the show. But just about that time, they started producing double-thickness drum heads, and so I would burn off the top and still be able to finish the show. And every single show, we would have to change the drum heads, right, at least on those toms.
It's costly.
It was, oh, sure. Hey, we were rolling in it. and then we played that. We played at Keith Moon's birthday party in Hollywood one year. And so he got up and jammed on those drums. And then a couple months later, I was watching the Midnight Special, and he was the special guest on Midnight Special, and he was playing a set of fives, clear drums, except in the floor tom-tom, he had it filled with water, and he had goldfish swimming around.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, what are your favorite songs of each other's?
Oh, well, that's a trick question. It's time to think about that.
It's okay, we can edit that out, the thinking time. Mm-hmm.
I like Only a Friend.
Oh. Only a Fiend.
That's it.
I like Me and My Stone.
All right.
I like Carry Me, actually. Nice song to sing.
I like Thunderclaps and Lightning.
There you go.
Yeah, same with me.
Yeah. I like Giant in the Streets.
Yeah. Same with me.
I think
Almost Home.
Yeah. It's so hard. All the other favorites I wrote.
So humble.
Well, there's many.
We definitely recognized each other's talents and somehow
incredible exactly. gifts.
But somehow we never collaborated in those days. That's an interesting point, and we just didn't.
I love Ronnie's stand-up.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I could rock with the best of them. Yes. Same three chords.
Yeah. So was that? Did that create any kind of tension? Like,
what do you mean?
No, forget it.
Not writing quit. Songs together.
I'm out of the band. I'm not doing that song.
There was always tension. You know,
creative friction.
Because you have to, you know, we're going into an album. We got three guys, and you got 10 songs, and Rich has, you know, written 14, right? And Ronnie's written half a dozen, and I have three or four. So the thing is, how are we going to work this out that we all get something on the album? And that was just, you know, you just get in there and butt heads for a while. Yeah.
The very nature of rehearsing anything, a new song or even a cover tune or what have you, has to do with kind of, you know, agreeing with each other with what you think is the right way to go about it. And the other guy will say, well, I think it's this way. And that, you know, so luckily we got through a lot of that.
But. And that is also, I mean, Mel was, he did keep some kind of balance. I mean, he did push to get, you know, a song or two of mine on the earlier albums. I was not welcome. If you'll look at our discography, the first album I had one song, and it kind of grew over the years. But no, it was all, you know, it's just the way it is. I think that's what most bands, that's why most bands break up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we broke up.
Yeah. When did you break up? What year?
Well, I don't know. It was a few years. I mean, Rich left first, then me. We left Ronnie out there all by himself with a, you know,
horn players.
This was after 13 years.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a quick breakup.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true.
Well, I would think that you left around 77. So if we left Calgary in 66, you guys were together 3 years before that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you got her on the head there, Cactus.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to ask you about my favorite song by you, Ronnie, which is Sally Ann.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know what the story behind that song was. If it's appropriate.
Well, it is. It is. I get influenced and inspired by anything that might, you know, come across one's mind. And I
think I probably another commercial on TV or some scene or setting or still photography somewhere of quite a beautiful girl in a Sally Ann outfit. And then it made me think of, you know, I don't come from a well-to-do family. So born in Europe, born in Holland, came here as a 7-year-old boy and struggled on a basically meat and potatoes kind of an existence with my family as best as possible. Many times my mother would go to the Sally Ann to get secondhand clothing for us kids, and we never knew the difference and so on. And I believe in some struggling years she even went to the Sally Ann for help, the Salvation Army. And I have to say it's one of my favorite charities. If I contribute, it's definitely, you know, there first and foremost. So, somehow a song came out, and I just thought, make this a good time, hold down, and feel good thing that, and kind of give these people, this organization a kudo,
right.
You know, to say well done, to accept anybody, to no matter what religion, creed, color, or anything else. Mm-hmm. That's why I have to say that they're.
Well, and also, there was like this Salvation Army. They always used to see like groups of musicians out there, you know, trying to collect, and they always seemed to have a tuba and a tambourine.
Yeah, exactly. So you pictured that in your mind.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks for liking it.
I love that song. So do you like the recording experience or live experience better?
I like them both, actually. I really like, you know, I mean, over the years, at some studios, most of them over the years have, like, had no windows, you know, so you're kind of in there right. In the dark, and it's like you're in a cocoon, and I kind of like that. And but I like getting out and playing. It's a bit of both. You couldn't, you know, it would be a drag to just do one.
Mm-hmm.
I must admit, I'm more the show off and the ham, and I have to have the immediate response and so on. I used to tell the powers that be, look, you want a good performance out of me out of the studio, bring some hot babes in and watch me show off. So I did definitely enjoy the live performing more so than the studio. In the old days when we used to take a day and a half to get a drum sound, I'd just, oh, look, boys, I'll be out playing pinball or whatever.
Yeah.
Call me when you got it. Your turn, Rich.
I like recording while playing live. That's it.
Okay. What was your biggest crowd that you ever played to?
Well, that would have been in Brazil.
Brazil,
everybody knows. Yes, it was a huge, huge auditorium, or not a sports hall, you know,
and a bowling soccer stadium.
Yeah, except there were no seats. There were just. It was just like steps, concrete levels, and people would bring something soft to sit on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big song festival. And when anyone was playing, if they liked you, well, they'd just get up and dance all around in there, mm-hmm. in the no seats, you know. But that was a huge crowd, and it was televised, and there were 100 million people or something that watched that.
Yeah, so the television and the live crowd, you know, was probably
would have been great if we'd been any good.
About 100,000 in that stadium there, what have you. But the different in cultures there was also that surprised the hell out of us, because if they didn't like somebody, they weren't shy about it. They would boo and whistle, I believe, was also and they pulled no punches. There was a blind person up there, blind guy like Jose Feliciano, doing quite well, but the crowd did not like him. Boo! Hiss! And he didn't know where to look.
Okay, it's kind of a vague question, but looking back, what was your favorite part of your career and all the heyday of everything? And
the breakup.
The girls. The food.
Okay.
Of course, the glory years are just sensational what turned out to be three young guys heading out to hit the big time. We dreamed about becoming the Beatles or that sort of thing, you know. And so when that eventually went down, and when we, you know, started getting huge crowds to come and see us and then clapping for songs we'd written and created. None of us really can read music. It's all street rock is what we call it. And
right.
We're just hackers from Bonas, Forest Lawn, and Calgary. And so when the glory years kicked in and we just said, this can't be. I mean, people offering us limousines, us two, we don't even want a limousine. Take it away. It was quite overwhelming. So
we don't want the royalties.
Yes.
No.
no retirement money. Do you want to just talk about your new songs?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got some new ones here, yeah.
Yeah.
We've been writing still. Yeah, we have.
Yeah, it's just tougher to get in and record them
because
we live all over the country now,
mm-hmm.
you know. And but, you know, just this last few days, as you know, we've done a couple of songs.
Songs?
Well, who knows, you know. Who knows what a hit song is?
Fun songs, good
but
songs.
They're good songs, and they've been a pleasure to do. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the see what happens to,
sure.
to
wrap them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think none of us really ever stopped writing as such,
yeah.
so even during the breakup years. So I've been influenced all over the place, and I just kind of just I used to worry about, gee, would this fit for the Stampeders, or gee, would this fit for Ronnie King? And then I stopped caring about that. I thought, just write a song, and whatever, you know, comes out. And I've written Celtic songs, the Ballad of John Cabot, and Keeper of the Light about lighthouses, because I was on a lighthouse with my brother Bob and his wife for a couple of really isolated on the West Coast, B.C. So... what I experienced, I would try to write about, and so mm-hmm. on, and
So we're trying to fit into our songs,
yes, well, rather than fit the songs into us.
Yes.
It feels good to get back in the studio.
Sure,
absolutely.
Yes, it does very much. Yes, it does, and we're not. I think it's a case of where we were once innovators, and we were influenced by the Beatles, who did all sorts of styles from rock to country, they're going to put me in the movies, etc. And there's no reason why we should be afraid to be that again, because we used to call our own style vegetable soup, because everything from country rock ballads to, you know, and then to hard rock, Wild
yeah.
Eyes, etc. Vegetable soup it was. That's the name of the new album.
Okay, I think that's good.
Great.
I'm going to put some, like...